a new century began. In London, the first soup kitchens were set up to relieve the hungry poor in a freezing January. Josiah Spode was perfecting his technique for making bone china, and the Royal Institution for Applied Science was founded. An act of union was passed between Britain and Ireland. In May, James Hadfield fired a shot at King George III at the Theatre Royal in Drury Lane, and within a year, Richard Trevithick would be demonstrating his steam passenger carriage. The modern world was dawning. For Collingwood, the new century began with frustrations. Throughout 1800, he was stationed in the West Country, at Torbay or Corsand Bay, near Plymouth. He raised his flag in Barfleur, the grand and spacious 98-gun three-decker in which he'd been flag captain at the glorious 1st of June. This was a time of short cruises in the Channel, with the constant fear that Napoleon would launch another invasion of Ireland, and the often terrible weather took its toll on both ships and men. Collingwood was becoming grumpier and more short-tempered, though his strong will prevented him from showing it to his men. He'd been ill, too, with a bowel complaint, cured by wearing a flannel waistcoat, and compounded by insomnia and depression. These were caused by boredom, lack of exercise, and the constant strain of command. Collingwood was notoriously bad at delegating, conducting business by himself that a modern manager would offload to a bevy of underlings. Meanwhile, there were rumours that secret negotiations were going on between Britain and France to bring about a peace settlement that everyone was desperate for. The thought made Collingwood long for home. Sarah was in the process of buying the house in Morpeth, where he could stroll in his garden along what he called his quarter-deck walk, plant vegetables and trees, and oversee the education of his daughters. But the war dragged on in desultory fashion through the winter and beyond, into 1801. Collingwood decided he could no longer wait for the joys of the conjugal embrace, so in mid-January, at the worst possible time of year, Sarah set off from Morpeth on the long and comfortable journey to Plymouth, bringing with her little Sal, now 8 years old, at leaving Mary Patience behind in the care of various aunts. Collingwood's account of her arrival paints a vivid and poignant scene. "I'd been reckoning on the possibility of her arrival that Tuesday, when about 2 o'clock I received an express to go to sea immediately with all the ships that were ready, and had we not then been engaged at a court-martial, I might have got out that day. But this business delayed me until near night, and I determined to wait on shore until 8 o'clock for the chance of their arrival. I went to dine with Lord Nelson, and while we were at dinner their arrival was announced to me. I flew to the inn where I had desired my wife to come, and found her and little Sarah as well after their journey as if it had lasted only for the day. No greater happiness is human nature capable of than was mine that evening, but at dawn we parted, and I went to sea." As did Nelson shortly afterwards, on a mission to the Baltic, where the government had decided that strong-arm tactics were required to prevent Denmark, Sweden and Russia making common cause with the French during peace negotiations. Nelson was junior commander to Sir Hyde Parker, a weak, dilatory man. In the furious battle that Nelson narrowly won at Copenhagen in April, Parker merely stood by and made his infamous signal to disengage, equally famously ignored by Nelson. Nelson's life was now much less harmonious than Collingwood's. He had finally split with the unhappy Fanny after his scandalous affair with Emma Hamilton, and as a result had been deliberately snubbed, not just by service colleagues, but even by the king himself. The victory at Copenhagen, though reinforcing his fame and glory in the eyes of the British public, brought him no nearer to his own inner peace. Collingwood never openly criticised his friend for what he called his attachment. He was far too loyal and knew his friend too well. But it must have given him cause for grief, as it did many of Nelson's friends, to see how easily his head had been turned by the ersatz glamour of the Neapolitan court and the charms of a manipulative, ambitious woman. Collingwood also had his doubts about the impending peace, for he thought it possible, and in the long run he was right, that it might prove illusory. He was more convinced by June 1802, when, finally, the Treaty of Amiens was signed, and he could at last go home to Morpeth. He wrote, "I am sure I have had my share of the war. I begun it early and see the last of it, and I hope it is the last we shall ever see." The peace lasted 14 months. Collingwood was at home again in Morpeth, writing to his friends as if he had never left home. I should recommend Northumberland for your residence. A fine, healthy air. In winter, a comfortable fire and friends about you that would be made happy by your neighbourhood. His preferred employment now was reading history, the education of his daughters, whom he barely knew, and the cultivation of his garden. His son-in-law recalled that on one occasion a brother admiral, who had sought him in the garden in vain, at last discovered him with his old gardener, Scott, to whom he was much attached, in the bottom of a deep trench, which they were busily occupied in digging. He had a busy social life, too, catching up on family, friends, and old acquaintances he had not seen for 3 years. And the family found time towards the end of the summer to go to the seaside at Newbiggin, where bathing cured all their colds and other minor ailments. Mary Patience, the youngest, had got over the measles, and Sal was hoping to catch it soon. Both were very diligent in their lessons. However, war was looming again, and Collingwood's contacts with government and the Admiralty gave him ample warning of it. While France was busy preparing for the next phase of the conflict, England's peace dividend from the treaty was the chance to stand down much of her expensive army and navy. Under the terms of the treaty, she agreed to give up Malta, on condition that its neutrality would be respected. Britain now saw that if she left the island it would immediately be taken by the French, and that left unchecked, Bonaparte would soon once again seize control of the Mediterranean. And so it was that in May 1803, Britain withdrew her ambassador from Paris and declared war on the old enemy. The country was soon awash with rumours that Napoleon was planning an invasion of England, as indeed he was. In Newcastle in June, a loyal armed association, 1,200 men strong, was sworn in. In August they marched to the town moor in 10 companies and received their muskets. There was a huge commotion across the region when beacon fires, standing ready in case of invasion, were accidentally lit, causing widespread panic. Collingwood received a letter from the Admiralty, asking if he was ready to go to sea at short notice. I answered, he wrote, to be sure I was, and packed up my trunk and my signal book, and am now waiting for a summons to take my station, wherever it may be. By July 1803 he was at sea again, having unwittingly said goodbye to Morpeth, Sarah and his girls for the last time. He was given command of Venerable, a 74-gun two-decker, and ordered to join Cornwallis on the Brest blockade. Guarding the mouth of the English Channel against invasion through the winter months must have been the worst job in the Navy. To add to the miserable discomfort of Atlantic gales and the tension of knowing that Bonaparte's 130,000-strong Army of England was poised to capitalise on any tactical errors, was the sailor's greatest horror, a lee shore. In order to blockade the French Channel fleet in Brest effectively, the English fleet had to stay as close to the coast as possible, but relentless southwesterly winds that forced them into treacherous coastal waters with their outlying rocks and wicked tidal streams meant constant danger of shipwreck. Collingwood's misery was compounded. He sailed Venerable out in such a hurry to join Cornwallis that he forgot to bring a spare coat. However, forever bearing the burden of responsibility, he confined his complaints to letters home. It was a station, he wrote, of great anxiety and required a constant care and lookout. I have often been a whole week without having my clothes off and sometimes up on deck the whole night. I was there longer than intended for want of a proper successor, and saw all my squadron relieved more than once. The Newcastle volunteers, with the 2 youngsters, joined about a fortnight since. They're a stout set of young men, and a great addition to my strength. Now was the time of greatest danger, and Collingwood was convinced that the blow would fall very soon. Frequently, he and his trusted lieutenant, John Clavell, would sleep together on deck on a gun, from which the admiral would rise from time to time to sweep the horizon with his night-glass, lest the enemy should escape in the dark. This night-glass, a telescope with low magnification but a huge light-gathering lens, is still preserved in the Discovery Museum in Newcastle. In December, Collingwood was in Plymouth, sheltering from storms that had destroyed several ships in the Channel. He then transferred to Culloden, another 74, and a veteran of the battles of the glorious 1st of June, Cape St. Vincent, and the Nile.